Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 3:06. Oh my gosh, it is Friday the 13th. The Friday the 13th edition of Political Rewind. Anything crazy can happen today. Republicans might decide to consolidate around Donald Trump. Democrats could be still trying to figure out whether they want to have a mid-70s socialist as their candidate for president. Just nuts here today. We'll talk about all of that and a lot more. We have the results, thanks to our good friend and colleague Jim Galloway of the newest AJC poll on presidential politics, on state elected officials, on the issues in Georgia that people have been following closely, and we're going to get to those right away. Jim Galloway, the political writer of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here with us as usual. You read his column in the Thursday and Sunday editions of the newspaper, and he also oversees the Political Insider blog, which you can read online. State Senator Nan Orrick, Democrat from Atlanta, is back. Nice to have you with us again.
Good afternoon. Good to be
here. Eric Tannenblatt, who is an advisor to Republican candidates at all levels. We haven't seen you in a while either, Eric, and it's a real pleasure to have you back in front of the microphone. And Buddy Darden, former Democratic congressman from Cobb County, joins us. Buddy, let's do a good and welfare as we start this show. Your wife, Lillian, just got a big honor a couple weeks ago.
Absolutely. She was selected to the Heroes, Saints, and Legends Award by Emory University and Wesley Woods for her contributions to the aging and their welfare in the state. And as I've said before, she's either a hero or a legend, but probably not a saint.
Well deserved.
It is well deserved. And that's why I wanted to mention it, because Lillian Darden has been involved with Wesley Woods for a very long time. So congratulate her. And if she happens to be listening, we congratulate her directly. All right.
Well,
let's get right to it. Jim Galloway, your poll is so extensive and covers so much ground that even before we came on the air, I was saying, well, what do you want to start with? State? You want to start with presidential? But I really think, given that we've been focusing on some important state issues in recent weeks, how about if we look at the interesting findings that your poll shows us about the governor, about Johnny Isaacson, about the issues that people care about? Is that fair?
Okay, so you want to start with Johnny Isaacson and the governor, right?
It's fine with me.
All right. Well, first of all, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't point you to myajc.com, where you can listen to all of these. You can see all these poll information in much more detail.
And we'll have a link to your site on our page.
I think the key on the gubernatorial level, Governor Nathan Deal has two vetoes that have really roiled the Republican Party. He's actually, it's interesting. On the religious liberty veto, that's the most polarizing. You have overall 45 to 44% approved, disapproved, so it's very, very close. Margin of error is about 4% there. But 58% of Republicans disapprove of the governor's veto of the religious liberty bill.
Yeah.
And 51% of general voters don't want to see that legislation come back. But again, 57% of GOP voters say they want to take another crack at religious liberty.
So the Josh McCoons of the legislature and the many others who are very supportive of religious liberty bill are getting some fuel from your poll that their Republican base wants them to continue this fight.
Exactly, and you're likely to see it's going to get pretty hot for Deal over at that GOP convention the 1st of June.
Yeah.
On campus carry. Okay, on campus carry. Here is where there's a little bit, the governor is in a little bit better standing. 56% of Georgia voters agree with his veto of legislation that would have allowed concealed carry on public university campuses. 59% of Republicans, again, disagree. And 59% of Republicans want to see that legislation come back again.
All right. So set the terms for us, if you would. This is a large sample. This is
a thousand Georgia voters.
Yeah.
Likely voters. The poll was conducted this week. It's by voice. No, not automation. And it was This is after this follows all of the legislative action.
Yeah, that's really the key to that. And let me let everybody weigh in on some of these findings. But before we do, Jim, if you gave it, I just missed it. Governor Deal, we had all wondered whether Governor Deal's overall approval rating was going to be hurt by these two vetoes, which are so important to the GOP base. And I think you show that he is still well on the positive side of his approval, right, in terms of approval ratings.
Right. It's not in the historic levels for that Republican governors have enjoyed, say, like immediately. Like Sonny Perdue, I think there were some times where he got beyond 60%. But I think this is more of a realistic level for someone in the middle of. I mean, we're in a huge presidential. We got a lot of turmoil, political turmoil going on. So he's doing fine. And Isaacson, Johnny Isaacson, does pretty well. His approval and reelect numbers. 42% of Georgia voters want to see him reelected. 42% approve of the job he's doing. But when you go over to the Republicans, and that's the side that counts, 54% of Republicans approve of what he's doing, roughly the same number, want him reelected.
All right, so before we go on with some more numbers, let me throw it out to all of you, to a buddy, Nan, Eric. What are your observations based on this?
Well, I had a little different take on the religious liberty numbers. You know, it wasn't, 60-40. I mean, it was roughly 50-50. So I'm not surprised by that. I think it shows that, Governor Deal had a good pulse of what the right thing to do for the state. 51%, I think you said, of Republicans want to see this come back. That's, half.
Oh, no, 59%. 59%.
Was campus carry.
No, 57% of Republicans want campus carry to come back.
Okay.
59% of Republicans want 57% want religious liberty to come back. 59% want campus carry to come back.
Okay. But I don't think that those numbers are as overwhelming as I think some may have thought that they would be.
Yeah, that is interesting, buddy or Nan, that you might expect, given the heated reaction to both of those vetoes, that the numbers for people who wanted both those bills back might have been much, much higher, yeah? What do you think?
Well, actually, he has made some decisions which most people, even if they disagree with him, think that he has exercised his judgment of what's best for the people of Georgia. And just because a few people might disagree with him, especially the more vocal ones, I think what he's done is kept Georgia out of the controversial positions that some of our neighbors in North Carolina and even as far north as Indiana go. So most people believe that while they might not have totally agreed with him, that he has had the best interest of the state at heart, and I think it's reflected in these numbers.
Well, I think too, as history moves forward and we see the states that go up in flames over this issue, and North Carolina is just up the road from us, that we're going to see more and more appreciation of the governor's decision on religious freedom.
Let me expand, Jim, if I may. We didn't give the numbers on the governor's approval rating, but I just got a hold of them because we should say to people, we're just seeing these numbers.
These are fresh.
Hundreds of pages of data.
You can still smell the yeast.
That's right. Here's what it says. About 52% of registered voters, not necessarily likely voters, registered voters, said they approve of Deal's performance. You guys say, at the Constitution, say that's up from 50% at the beginning of the year, right before the General Assembly session started. About 33% disapprove of Republicans disapprove of the governor's performance. His approval rating was 51% among Democrats, interesting, and 58% among Republicans. But the Constitution goes on to say the survey found serious cracks in Deal's Republican base. GOP approval for the governor has fallen from 73% in January. So we are seeing in these numbers a real erosion of his base support as a result of the vetoes, we imagine.
And I think what we're also seeing is that there's a growing middle in Georgia. and these numbers reflect that. I have conversations every day with Democrats in my deep blue district who admire the political courage of Governor Deal in making both of these vetoes. And I think you're seeing you're seeing people come together, party aside, around a consensus in the middle, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, and the other thing too is if you look back in history, the governor always drops right after the legislative session, and then he recovers. And so I'd look at the numbers in the fall, and I think you'll see Governor Deal's numbers will be higher.
Okay, Jim, do you happen to have? And again, we're kind of looking through the raw data here. We're baking an apple pie right live in front of your eyes.
Looking for the cinnamon, yeah.
Do you have the numbers on the approval, disapproval of the legislature? Because that's a fairly significant number.
I had them, and
here's what I've got.
They were fairly disappointing.
I've got this.
But not as bad as Congress.
Yeah, well, that's right. Georgia legislature, 46% approve, 42% disapprove, 13%, they're not paying enough attention. Why do we even talk to those people? So that's not bad. I mean, they're more positive than negative, but under 50%. Yeah, buddy?
Well, we got to remember also that people don't get as involved in state issues as they do the national issues. And after all, these are representatives. They're not supposed to mirror the exact views of everybody that comes up. They're supposed to come in and exercise their best judgment and do what's best for the state. So I think this is reasonably high when you look at the way people have looked at government and Congress in general.
Well, and the other interesting thing about this is there's so much talk about Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders being these outsiders at the federal level and people being so disappointed in Washington, D.C. And people want to know, does that translate down to the state level? And you have a lot of competitive legislative races this time where you have these outsiders that are trying to, you know, follow the Trump model. And will that work at the state level like it does at the federal level? And I think these numbers show that they probably won't.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's fascinating about this is just what you're talking about, Eric. This week, the Constitution ran an article saying that Republican incumbents who voted for the transportation tax hike are getting some pretty significant challenges in their districts for reelection. But the AJC poll, when you drill down on the approval disapproval of legislators, says that among Republicans, 55% approve, only 30% disapprove. That doesn't sound like a number that offers a lot of openings for non-incumbents, does it?
Well, actually, you know, I think we need to move a little bit further into the presidential numbers, because I think that will I can make an argument using the presidential numbers that if you're a legislator and Republican in a few certain areas in Georgia, you do have to worry about what's coming
right
in November.
Let's,
but Jim, doesn't that have everything to do with the way the districts have been gerrymandered to where you've packed in Republicans, you've bleached out districts, and so a small vocal core on the right wing has no balancing on the left side in these districts we're talking about.
But you have some specific districts in Metro Atlanta, and I'm thinking a lot of Gwinnett, a lot of inside the perimeter here in Atlanta, where number one, Democrats could really fend off Republican attempts to take over because of the Trump
That's
effect.
That's right.
Taylor Bennett, Scott Holcomb, both are White House Democrats.
That's right.
And they've got targets on their back, but I don't think this is a year for Republicans to take them down.
But I'm talking more in the primaries that are coming up.
I was thinking in the primaries.
I don't think that that's going to matter.
All right, before we turn to presidential, let's look at the numbers that Jim alluded to a minute ago. And, buddy, I want to get, as a former member of the United States House of Representatives, I want to get you to weigh in this right away. Asked for their feelings, approving or disapproving of the way U.S. Congress is doing its job. The AJC found 21% approve, 74% disapprove. But, buddy, among Republicans, 15% say, yeah, they're doing a darn good job, and 80% say, no, they're not. Part of that anti-establishment feeling running through the Republican Party?
And the amazing thing is that there's 9 of our 13 representatives from Georgia, of the 14 representatives of Georgia, are Republicans. Mm-hmm. Both of our senators are Republicans. So what does that tell us? Does that mean that they don't think their own people are doing well? You know, Mark Twain said there's no distinctly recognizable criminal class in the United States unless it is Congress. And I kind of resented that, frankly, when I was up there. But people just always love to beat up on Congress. They want to blame Congress
and
for everything.
Yeah. Even 15% approval of Congress among Republicans, you know, I think that beats a few national polls.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think that's exactly right. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We have some great presidential numbers to look at. But why don't we get a break out of the way fairly early? By the way, we'd love to hear from you on Twitter, at PoliticsGPB. Let us know what you're thinking as you hear these polling numbers and what they mean to you out there. It is 3:21 on Friday afternoon. We're going to take a short break and come right back.
This is member-supported Georgia Public Broadcasting and 18-station radio network. Good afternoon. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University with 8 colleges and schools, including the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies. Thanks for joining us for Political Rewind.
My name is Sonari Glinton. I'm a business reporter. NPR is asking tough questions and searching for the answers. NPR is witnessing the moment of triumph or finding what's at the heart of a disaster. It's a neighborhood saloon or backstage at Carnegie Hall. It's journalists across the globe and in your town. NPR is this relationship between you and me. This is NPR.
Welcome back to the Friday the 13th edition of Political Rewind. We have with us today State Senator Nan Orrick, former U.S. Congressman Buddy Darden, Republican advisor to presidential candidates, presidents, and many others in the Republican Party, Eric Tannenblatt, and the AJC political writer Jim Galloway. We're walking through the highlights of the AJC's poll just out this afternoon. We're very happy and really appreciate, Jim, your sharing this with our listeners as among the first people to get these findings. So thank you.
No, not at all. Go to myajc.com for more details, but not while you're driving.
So, Jim, I think that the presidential polling numbers, we acknowledge, I think all of us, that we're 6 months out. Nevertheless, we have to start setting benchmarks at some point. And so your numbers certainly do that. Let's start walking through those numbers.
All right. This is the first poll that we've had that we've done since Donald Trump has become the presumptive nominee, which kind of helped clear the field, made it a little less muddy.
That was good. Eric, you didn't know flinch when he said presumptive nominee.
No, he is the presumptive nominee.
We'll talk about that. I know he is, but you're not emotional anymore about it.
No, and I'll tell you this. I think he's going to be the next president.
All right, we're going to get to that.
Now I'm flinching.
All right. Let's get to that. I think that's a great place to have our conversation in a few minutes.
Okay.
But let's do the numbers.
Okay. Here are the numbers. In a hypothetical, still hypothetical, Trump-Hillary Clinton matchup, Trump in Georgia leads Clinton 47-44%. That's within the margin of error. Very close. Clinton only just barely splits with Trump among women. Trump dominates men 49-40%, and Clinton just edges Trump out among independents 43-42%. Where Clinton really drills Trump is on the question of whether who would be best for the middle class.
And she, are you
49? She gets those voters 49-41%.
All right, let's absorb that for a minute, if we may. Nan Orrick, we know that the votes of women are crucial in any presidential race. And what I'm hearing from the AJC poll, the way that Jim described it, is at least in Georgia, women are pretty evenly divided between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton right now. Does that surprise you at all? Because I assume it's not only talking about Republican and Democratic women, and there's some independent women, I assume, in that, but who don't identify as either.
Well, didn't you just say, Jim, they split the independents?
Right, but Bill is actually being a little bit unfair because we've got to go to the next step. There's a curveball in this poll.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, the curveball is that in a hypothetical Donald Trump Bernie Sanders matchup, Bernie Sanders crushes Trump 50-43%.
There you have it. That's why I've said all along, I'm glad Bernie Sanders ran.
Bernie Sanders wins.
We've gotten a lot of people out and interested, and we've surfaced the issues around the middle class, the vanishing middle class.
Bernie Sanders wins men 48-46. He has broader appeal among women than Clinton does. He beats Trump 53-41% among them. And he has broader appeal among independents than Clinton, 52-35%.
Those numbers are not shocking for this reason. Hillary Clinton has been taking hits from the Republicans for 25 years. They've got a long chapter and verse about her that they've been pounding through the echo chamber of GOP talk shows, et cetera, for 25 years. The Republicans have not really turned on Sanders. In fact, some of them turn into the voting booth and voted for him in some of these states in the primaries that have open primaries because they think that he's more beatable. So he has not been the whipping boy for 25 years.
Well, and I think also because of the 25 years, I think people are tired of her. And I think that Bernie Sanders, like Donald Trump, is representing something new and fresh and is tapping in to this anger out there in the electorate, and she's the epitome of the establishment.
I don't doubt at all that there's Clinton fatigue here, no question about it. And I even noticed at the end of President Clinton's second term. However, once people get the issues drawn and they've got to decide between, and the decision will be between Donald Trump and will be between Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
In all fairness to Bernie Sanders, he's really not in the picture insofar as the nomination is concerned. And then your choices between those two. I'm a little surprised, pleasantly, by the way, that it's that close in Georgia right now. I expected Trump
That's
to be further ahead, but who knows? This is a snapshot, and who knows what we're going to have.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by what did you say, 47-44 that Trump was winning. But if you drill down and you look at the individual parties, Trump has not consolidated all the Republicans yet. And I think over the course of the next 2 months leading up to the convention and then leading into the general election, he's going to consolidate the Republican base, and then you're going to see his numbers grow.
Well, I would agree with you that Trump will probably carry Georgia, and Georgia will stay red. However, he's going to have to come to Georgia and have to spend some resources here, and I don't think his taking it is a given unless he makes some effort.
Well, and also Hillary Clinton has not brought the resources and her campaign to Georgia. And the minority party is not calling the shots here. So that has yet to come.
Let's get Jim back.
One of the more interesting data points in this poll, I think, is we asked voters their impressions of the Republican and Democratic parties. 27% of Republicans had an unfavorable view of the Republican Party. That shows that there's some fence mending that needs to be done.
Well, we just had a big family argument here in the primary, and we're only a couple weeks since Donald Trump became the presumptive nominee, and so you have a lot of people that supported other candidates that have not accepted that yet.
I don't want to pass by one crosstab in this hypothetical Trump-Sanders matchup, and that's that Sanders beats Trump in Georgia in your poll among men. Now, to me, that's counterintuitive, Buddy or Nan. I mean, what we're thinking throughout as we picture a matchup down the road, we're thinking that Donald Trump is going to have a huge appeal among men. Now, I haven't seen the racial breakdown on those men yet, but is that strike you as surprising?
It's been documented for some time now. The white men that feel pushed out of the economy, left behind, waning options, the world is changing, and Bernie Sanders' message around building an economy that's not for the 1%, but that's for the rest of us.
But that's Trump's message too.
Well,
there was very interesting. Alan Abramowitz over at Emory University, the day after on Wednesday, the day after the West Virginia primary, won by Bernie Sanders, he kind of took this on, and basically what he found, he was looking at exit polls and saw that Bernie Sanders won among of voters who wanted a more conservative president than Barack Obama, and he won among voters who wanted a more liberal president than Barack Obama. So basically, you had Clinton taking the votes of those who wanted to continue the Obama administration. And what Abramowitz is saying, what you've got here at work here is you have an incumbency issue here. Clinton has become so identified with the Obama administration, and she embraced that at the outset of the Democratic Party, that is starting to hurt her a little bit in the general election climate.
I agree, but you can't change your colors, and I don't think she has any choice except to try to be who she is, because if she started now running as a non-incumbent, as an outsider,
sure,
it would be a really big joke.
She was a member of the cabinet.
Oh, absolutely, Secretary of State. But I will say this, and you've got to give credit to Bernie Sanders. I have been totally astounded at his receptivity by the electorate and his ability and his skills as a candidate. I knew him. We served in Congress together. And if I had to pick the five most unlikely people ever to be a candidate for president and to get this kind of attention, he would have been among the most unlikely.
The other part of this is if Donald Trump takes it takes men against Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders takes men against Donald Trump. That tells you that support for Trump may be a little bit thin, and that a lot of people are going for Trump in a Clinton Trump matchup simply because of their antipathy toward Clinton, and not because they like Trump.
All right, we have any? I think we've.
Let me just one more point is what's going to be another factor in this as it unfolds is how Bernie Sanders is going to play his hand in these next weeks and months in terms of bringing his base and that enthusiasm and that fervor into the Clinton campaign.
Well, when the Clinton campaign sees these numbers, they may want to consider him to be her VP. They want a shot at Georgia.
There you go.
Well, there you go. Well, hey.
Well, what does that do to Newt?
So, Jim Galloway, your polling numbers are just really fascinating. And again, we really appreciate your sharing them with the Political Rewind listeners this afternoon. Obviously, as you pointed out, they're going to be our listeners can find them online. They can go to your website directly,
right? And we will point you to myajc.com,
and we'll have that link posted on the Political Rewind blog today. Again, we're at Politics GPB. Khalid tweeted us. He said, "When Trump is done with Hillary, Democrats are going to have buyer's remorse." Interesting. And Sam Burnham tweeted. He said, "Gerrymandering keeps coming up for Democrats, but they didn't mind when Tom Murphy did it and they bragged about it." Well, it wasn't.
Actually, it was
Roy
Barnes.
There you go. Let's talk presidential as long as we've started down that path. And Eric, this is the first time you've been back with us since Trump became the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. The meeting took place in Washington yesterday, Paul Ryan and Donald Trump, the much heralded meeting. And we know that Paul Ryan, who has said so far, "I'm not ready to commit," still isn't committing, but they came out playing nice. Are we seeing the beginning of a coalescing mainstream Republicans continuing, really, around Donald Trump? And let me ask you, as a guy who really believed very much in Jeb Bush, how you're feeling about all this?
Well, I to answer your first question, I do think that you're going to see the coalescing around Donald Trump. He's the presumptive nominee. And I think the next 2 months, you're going to see the party unite behind him leading into the convention. I think I would predict by the time we get to Cleveland, the party's going to be united. Now, there'll be some people that may never get on board. But, you know, you've already seen in the last week that the momentum is building. I think that Paul Ryan was very clear that he had not spent much time with Donald Trump. And yesterday was an opportunity to do that. I think he'll get there. He's going to chair our convention. And I think that it's going to be important for Paul Ryan and for our congressional majorities that we're all unified. And I think you're going to also see Donald Trump learning a lot from the Republican leaders. And so now, in terms of me personally, this is, you know, I'm sort of like Paul Ryan. I want to see more. I've said that if you break it, you buy it. And we just went through a very grueling primary. Donald Trump said some things about some of the candidates that hurt those that supported those candidates. There's some positions he's taken that caused some people to take pause. And he now has to be magnanimous. And he now needs to show those people that didn't support him why we should. And I'm hopeful that that's going to happen. And I think that the party's going to be unified, because the one thing that we can all unify behind is that we do not want to see Hillary Clinton get elected president. The stakes are very high. One thing that there hasn't been a lot made of that you're going to start hearing more and more is the balance of the courts and the Supreme Court. And I think that...
But you really have no idea of where Donald Trump stands on potential Supreme Court nominees.
But I agree with Eric here. I think Eric, as it's been said before, Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love. But the Republicans have already begun to articulate this court issue. And I was told by a former colleague of Eric's recently that the real play this year by the Republicans is going to be to keep the Senate and to emphasize the importance of the presidency to the court. That's their play, and to take the
in order to get the religious conservatives back in the
sure.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
means
sure.
they choke down Donald Trump, which means they swallow that hard, hard proposition
right.
that man's worthy of being president of this country.
And the charm offensive that Trump has going on these days, I think will continue. But I think he will be played down, and they will go to more of a philosophical national welfare.
Okay, Eric, I'm not trying to pick on you. But
no, go ahead.
I'm used
to it.
You have been a major fundraiser for Republican candidates for president over the years. You're highly respected in that role and in the advice that you give to presidents and presidential candidates. Are you going to be able to go out and help Donald Trump build up a war chest?
Well, I'm committed to making sure that the party has the resources to make sure we can keep our majorities in the House and the Senate. And in order to do that, we have to be a united party. Now, right now, I'm not out there raising money for Donald Trump. Now, Donald Trump didn't raise any money during the primary campaign. One of the things that was discussed yesterday with the chairman of the RNC and Speaker Ryan was, you know, them coming together, forming a joint fundraising committee. That hadn't all been finalized yet. I know that there's a lot of conversations that are taking place to get donors all to rally around the Republican National Committee. And I think over time that's going to happen.
So, Jim, let me ask you, to start with you, and I think this is worth going around the table on. The question becomes, we're all seeing the coalescing happening, and happening awfully quickly, despite the fact that Paul Ryan says, well, I've got to make up my mind. People are coming around him. Certainly here in Georgia, we've discussed it. The governor has now said, I wish Mitt Romney hadn't attacked Trump the way he did. He hasn't quite endorsed him yet, but he moves in that direction. David Ralston has said, yeah, I'm going to work with him.
Lynn Westmoreland, the congressman, has come down on Paul Ryan for playing coy.
Right. Is this a matter of 2016 expediency? As Eric says, they want to elect a Republican president. But what does this do to the identity of the Republican Party looking to 2020, to 2024 and beyond?
This is why Cleveland is going to be so interesting. Now that we've settled the nomination of Donald Trump, you are going to have a platform committee. And they're going to have to decide which part of Trump's speeches to incorporate into that. The wall will be no problem, I don't think. But his feelings on gender identity and abortion might be. Ted Cruz has made clear that his supporters are really going to fight to keep that conservative soul there.
Yeah, you know, I have a theory with both parties with regards to the platform. I think because of what Bernie Sanders has done and what he'll likely demand at the Democratic convention, and the supporters of Ted Cruz, who are going to make up a lot of the numbers of the delegates at the convention, I don't think those platforms are going to matter that much. I think that they're probably going to allow those candidates and those delegates to get what they want in the platform, and the presidential candidates are going to run the way they want to run.
All right. As members of the loyal opposition, Nan and Buddy, I would really love to get your take on this as well. Are the Democrats, by trying to win 2016, cutting off their noses to spite their faces, as especially in a state like Georgia, which is going to be turning purple in the not too distant future.
Georgia's purple now. We are the purplest of the red states.
Yeah, except
from,
that,
based on the last
except that even you say
election.
That Hillary Clinton isn't going to win here in the fall.
You didn't hear me say that.
Well, maybe Buddy said
that. Yeah, I think that.
That
was Buddy.
I said things stand there as you want.
And I pointed out. I pointed out that we've not had Clinton on the ground in Georgia with a ground game and with the money in Georgia. I'm waiting to see the ads that go up about Donald Trump's buffoonery and his scandalous depiction of women and his constant attacking of women in very personal and hateful ways. There's a lot of footage out there that the Democrats are going to use to make it quite clear who this Trump character is.
All right, Buddy, let me ask you, are Republicans in the long run creating for themselves an identity problem that will come back to haunt them in elections far beyond 2016?
The Republicans?
Republicans. I didn't say it that way.
I don't think there's any question that Republicans have established themselves as a party of grumpy old men, grumpy old white
men.
I think the Democrats have the path for a long-term domination of the presidency. Now, you got to remember that President Obama got over 46% both times when he ran
in Georgia.
So we were not that far away. But of course, when the off year comes out and the gubernatorial elections, we get slaughtered and lost the Senate race, for example, and the governor's race when we had two very, very fine candidates. So in my view, we're playing the long game. But I think the long game might be coming toward the end right here in 2016. I think we got an excellent shot. But again, who knows where this thing is going from here. And Donald Trump has really been underestimated throughout this entire campaign. We all laughed at Donald Trump 6-8 months ago. So he's been underestimated over and over and over again. So I'm reluctant to get out there and underestimate him again.
I've said on this show at least 4 times in the last 2 weeks, Democrats are at their own. They are at peril if they think Donald Trump is going to somehow be easy to beat. Donald Trump has shown he knows how to win votes.
He has defied all of the odds. And you know, the last 2, 3, 4 election cycles, I've heard my distinguished Democratic colleagues talk about, we're becoming purple. We're going to take over. Michelle Nunn's going to win the Senate race. We are still a Republican state. And quite honestly, Governor Deal's recent vetoes of things like the Religious Liberty Bill is a great example of how the party is moving to deal with the demographic changes. And I think it's going to sustain the Republican power for years to come.
Jim, we're going to take a break, but I want to give you a last chance to get in a word before we do about all this. Do you have some wisdom to impart upon us?
Well, I would say just to Eric's point, if you look at the numbers on Hillary Clinton in a Hillary-Trump matchup, Hillary Clinton took only 20% of the white vote. Donald Trump took 35% of it. I think she's going to have to find a way to get a little bit more of that vote before we can think about Georgia turning purple, I think.
Okay, let's do this. Let's get our last break of the show out of the way at 3:44 in the afternoon. When we come back, I want to do a couple things. First, I think we should have a quick discussion about Bernie Sanders and the Wall Street Journal's mischievous editorial this week in which they said there is a path for him to be the nominee, and it's gotten a lot of response. And then we're going to talk about transgender bathrooms, which continues to be almost as controversial an issue as religious liberty. We're here on GPB Radio, Political Rewind, back in a minute.
Oncologist Siddhartha Mukherjee says for years, cancer treatments were formulaic. Now, advances in science have him asking different kinds of questions.
How much information can I glean from this individual patient's tumor? Can I understand something about its particular behavior? And now, can I cleverly tailor some therapy?
Precision treatments for cancer later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut with Jim Galloway of the AJC. You see his column on Thursdays and Sundays. in the paper. And, of course, he oversees Political Insider, the blog that keeps us updated almost on an hourly basis about what's going on here in Georgia and across the country in politics. Republican Eric Tannenblatt, Democrats got one Republican, two Democrats today. Okay, we do it the other way a lot too. Buddy Darden
and
Nan Oreck are joining us. Real quick, Bernie Sanders won't go away, Nan Oreck. He continues to feel there's a path for him to get the nomination. And the Wall Street Journal added to that this week by writing an editorial in which they make the argument for why Bernie Sanders can go into Philadelphia for the convention and turn it into a contested convention. And they say, of course, that path has to do with turning superdelegates who commit on their own to the candidate they want to support. They're not bound by primary results. They're not bound by their state's conventions. And Sanders' argument is, and the Wall Street Journal argument is, that a lot of those people committed to Hillary long before Bernie Sanders was involved in this race, before anybody saw that he was going to win 19 states. Is this just silly talk?
Well, we haven't selected our superdelegates altogether. There'll be a meeting in Macon tomorrow. And I don't expect for a moment, when I look at my colleagues in the House and Senate, it was not even you could count them on less than one hand of who was backing
them.
Sanders. That's right. Four of them, exactly. And so I don't see vacillation on that count. I do think respecting Sanders, respecting his performance, the ideas that he surfaced, the energy and enthusiasm of the base that he has identified and mobilized are very important. And I expect we'll come out with a very much unified party out of the convention. I expect Hillary Clinton will be our standard bearer. And I don't at all see a pathway of superdelegates vacillating.
Buddy, let me reframe the question, and then you'll answer it the way you want to, but let me try. There is talk now that the Sanders campaign is going to go into the convention, and whether they themselves can win or not, they are going to do their best to take down the whole notion of superdelegates, because there are many people who talk about, Trump talks about the rigged Republican competition. Superdelegates sure strike a lot of people as being a rigged Democratic device.
Well, we're all walking on eggshells right now around Bernie Sanders, because the last thing we want to do is have some kind of big blow up and have the kind of situation happen that the Wall Street Journal would be delighted to happen. And they would love to see that happen at the Democratic convention. However, I think our way of selecting delegates, and including party elders and including people who have paid their way over the years and who have earned their respect of the party, I think people like that ought to be considered. I think John Lewis, for example, who has been for many, many years mainstay of the Democratic Party, he's a superdelegate. Of course, he ought to be able to give the party advice and counsel and have an influence on it. And I could go on and on, but the bottom line, our party chairman, our party exec, all these people, but all of our congressmen ought to be superdelegates, but because they've been elected, they've been out there and they've fought the political battles over the years. So I believe that the combination of having delegates elected and by primaries and so forth, and also a portion by superdelegates, is good. But I would point out that in any way you count it, in total number of votes cast, Hillary is far, far ahead of Bernie Sanders by...
Well, I don't think she's that far out in front of pledged delegates, is she really?
Far out in front of pledged delegates, oh yes.
Well, no, she's out front, but it's under 200 delegates, I think.
But if you look at the numbers, in every way she comes out far ahead.
Okay.
So she'll be our nominee, and we want to give Senator Sanders the respect he deserves. We want to make his exit as... painless as possible, but in the end, we've got to come together.
And what happens between now and the convention if the FBI takes some action against Hillary Clinton? How does that impact the superdelegates?
Yeah.
First of all, I don't anticipate that's going to happen, But if there should be an extraordinary circumstance under which Secretary of State Clinton is unable to continue her campaign forward, I think you'll probably see Vice President Biden or someone else.
But actually, you did have somebody from the FBI before Congress this week who said that he's not even sure that this case is going to be is going to be put out there before the election's over. He's got no reason to do so, he says.
Yeah, although I don't imagine how Comey doesn't wake up at 3 every morning tossing and turning over the bind he's gotten himself into around this. Let's move on because we're a little bit short on time. Jim Galloway, I'm going to turn to you on this, if I may. But before I do, we got some more tweets. Brian Thomas says, when Trump fails to get Mexico to pay for the wall, then what will Congress do? $15 billion. Marie says, in response, really, she said it before we did, it's all in James Comey and Loretta Lynch's hands to give Bernie the nomination. So thank you for that. Jim, we've seen the transgender issue really get hotter this week because the federal government told North Carolina that if they don't rescind their law, and they gave them 3 days to do it, that they would be looking at losing something like $2 billion in federal education money. And the state of North Carolina, Governor McCrory turned around and said, well, if you want to sue us, we'll sue you right back.
And everybody's suing each other. Then we had an eruption in Fannin County.
That's what I was hoping you'd get to. This has come home.
This is the speaker's, this is in the speaker's 7th district. He has weighed in very gently on this thing, but you've got parents in Fannin County upset. There is a transgender child in one of the schools, and now we're having a debate over bathroom rules here. Now you had the White House today issue a set of guidelines that it wants all public schools to follow when it comes to transgender.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Trevor Noah on The Daily Show weighed in on North Carolina. We'll just listen to it for about a minute because we need a break from all the serious talk.
North Carolina, at what point would you admit that you are taking this too far? Because you realize you've already been sharing the bathroom with trans people for your entire lives, and you've never noticed it. And why would you? Because it's a public bathroom. You're supposed to go in there, mind your own business, and get out as fast as you can. That's all you do. If you can ID anyone, if you can ID anyone else who was in the bathroom with you, you were paying too much attention.
Trevor Noah on the Daily Show.
And at the same time, you know, you can't make this up. They announced with great pride in North Carolina, the governor announced that they've set up a 911 line to call in and report anybody you see in the wrong bathroom.
All right. Well, let's bring it back home, though, Jim. the speaker is in what could be a tight election.
No, I'm not sure about that. He is in a primary contest. Sam Snyder, former high school wrestling coach, ran against him 2 years ago.
Right.
Was dispatched by the speaker. He's running against him again. I don't know if it's going to be
fine.
But he does have it. But I think what's more is interesting is that the White House has been so quick to jump into this because of the geography, the North Carolina aspect of this, because North Carolina, I think, with HB2, this is the bill underlying it all. Pat McCrory's actions. You have Senator Burr there who may be vulnerable. I think we're seeing a Republican play for North Carolina here. It's just getting ready to start.
Could be. And you also have a governor's race going on up there where the attorney general, who refused to file the lawsuit, is running against the incumbent governor. But I believe, and let's give Donald Trump his due here, he had an opportunity to really fan the flames here several days ago. But all of a sudden, he shocked and surprised everyone, including Ted Cruz, by saying that, hey, no, this is no big deal. It ought to be up to the individual to decide what bathroom to go to.
Nan Orrick, with all this commotion, let's bring it again right back to Georgia. Do you imagine, as a member of the esteemed state legislature, that we're going to see somebody introduce a bill, maybe even pre-file a bill that will try to block any efforts to allow transgender bathrooms?
You know, the crowd up at the General Assembly that makes their money and makes their political hay off of beating up on this or that minority is alive and well. We saw gay bashing. You know, it was black bashing before that, and that goes way back, and people of all parties participated in that. But we've seen gay bashing up there since the 90s, and yes, there are likely to be bills filed around transgender issues. And what's lost in all of this is the reality that we're talking about real people with hearts and souls who suffer incredible discrimination, who, you know, 50% of transgender youth report that they have had suicidal tendencies and thoughts. There's pain in this picture, and people of goodwill being able to walk in the shoes of those who need empathy, not discrimination.
I'm going to say something that I recognize could imagine people coming back at me on this. But Eric, it took a great many people in this country some time to accept gay relationships. And we've moved in an amazing direction on that. I mean, now Supreme Court says gay marriage is the law of the land. We're more embracing of gay relationships in the community than ever before. Can we imagine, not the discrimination aspect, but can we imagine that it's going to take some people time, having just gone through the gay battle over gay rights, to absorb what the transgendered community deserves to have as its rights in this whole thing as well? I think even Jeff Graham of Georgia Equality has been rather gentle in the way he's talked about this issue. It's not that the rights aren't there and shouldn't be. I'm not suggesting they don't deserve them. But this is another social issue that takes some time for people to absorb. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's very fair. I think it's very fair. Another aspect, I don't want to change the subject, but another piece of this that I think will tie into this election is the White House's action now is another example of federal government overreach. And I think that that is going to really mobilize and energize people that want to see a change of this administration, which even though Barack Obama's not running again, as I think Buddy or Nan said, I mean, this is like a third term of Barack Obama, and I think that's going to backfire on Hillary Clinton.
But getting back to Nan's point is that the when you have debates erupt like this in specific communities, all right, say in Fannin County, there is a single individual being discussed here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is just that is just highly disturbing. And you can see it in the letter that Speaker Ralston sent to Isaacson and David Perdue. Yes, he complained about the federal overreach, but he says, "I recognize the sensitive nature of caring for and educating children, and my intent in bringing this matter to your attention is not to single out any individual student." And yet you do.
Yeah. Yeah. But also Ralston writes this in kind of the way I'm asking you about, which is he's trying to be a little bit more thoughtful and not go to the wall, not go to the barricades over. All right, look, we are completely out of time. This show flew by today, but Buddy Darden, Nan Orrick, Eric Tannenblatt, and of course, my colleague Jim Galloway, thanks for a wonderful Political Rewind today. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll be back here again next Wednesday at 2 o'clock with, again, too much to talk about, too little time to do it. Have a wonderful weekend. See you next week.